very much, Valeria, for the introduction. So yeah, as I just mentioned, my lab at McMaster is called NeuroArts, and so I'm trying to develop a neuroscientific approach to pretty much all the arts that we work on. We work on music and dance, theater, acting, storytelling, drawing, as well as aesthetics, creativity. I have a separate line of research looking at cross-cultural musicology, so we look at music from an evolutionary perspective in terms of migration, so I won't talk about that today, but that's kind of my take is the NeuroArts lab at McMaster. So we've had two very intense days about joint improvisation, and we've heard just about every possible concept, but we've heard almost nothing, very little about this, and for me, this is what it's all about, and so improvisation is nothing if not a form of creativity. And so for me, this field that we're trying to develop has to be based in the study of creativity and nowhere else. And so by creativity, typically we talk about the generation of novel ideas or novel products, or from a cultural standpoint, the generation of diversity, having more products rather than less through the action of creativity and innovation. And so this is my take on the literature, is that there's a genuine creativity-improvisation divide. What I mean by that is if you read the mainstream literature on creativity, there's almost no mention of improvisation. If you read the improvisation literature, there's almost no mention of standard theorizing in creativity. There's a huge divide, and so I think this has to come together as a synthesis. Right now, it's a very divided set of fields, but I think for us at this conference, we definitely have to put improvisation within the larger umbrella of creativity and creativity theory. It's really just an issue of time scales. We do creativity either typically on the long time scale of days, weeks, and months, and years, or we do it spontaneously in the short time frame. That's really the only difference. So we have this, I'll use the term composition as a generic term to talk about long-term creativity. Either in the long run, doing experiments, creating artworks over the course of days and years, whatever, or we do it in the moment, and we call that improvisation. So basically, improvisation is sort of this, but happening in the time scale of performance. So that's the way I think about improvisation, is this, but happening in the time scale of a performance. And so we think about, okay, there are people like Shakespeare who spent years and years writing these great plays. We have these interpreters like Laurence Olivier who are very creative interpreters, although he didn't write the play. He's not a writer, he's an interpreter. And then improvisation is sort of doing this, but in the time scale of that. So then improv actors or people who do device theater, they're doing what Shakespeare is doing, but doing it in the time scale of Olivier. So essentially, improvisation is what I'm calling composition, but occurring in the time scale of a performance. So again, if we look at the standard literature, there have been models going back to the 1950s, but a very influential model these days, or since the 90s, is called the Gene Plour model, due to the work of people like Fink and Ward and Smith. And it's a very, I think, very intuitive idea that, creativity starts with the generation of ideas, but these ideas are not fully formed and completed. We have to go through a long process of then exploring those ideas, and then through the process of exploration, we come back and generate new ideas, and we have all these cycles and cycles, iterations of generation and exploration. So this stands for generation and exploration. So again, we get these ideas, but they're not fully formed ideas. They're kernels of ideas. We go through a long process of exploration and these cycles of generation and exploration, and that's the Gene Plour model of creativity. And so people liken creativity to a process of problem solving or to a process of trial and error learning, what we call operant conditioning in psychology. And some people liken it to a Darwinian process that we have this overabundance of potential ideas, and then through the process of exploration, we hone in on particular ideas, and we go through this cycle of variation and selection to create products. And so I think one of the most important ideas, maybe the most important idea that comes from the psychology of creativity, is that creative work almost always is based on a core idea. When you do an experiment or create an artwork, you have some kind of basic overriding idea that's going to drive the project. And what's important is that the idea is neither fully formed, totally complete, nor is it random. It's some kind of work in progress. It's a kernel idea. Then you're going to spend days and weeks, months, years, whatever, developing the idea. So if it's going to be a science experiment or an artwork, you have some kind of basic overriding idea that's driving the work. It's not fully formed. It's going to take you time to go through the generation, exploration to develop the idea. And so Mason Ward, within the umbrella of Gene Plour, did a very important study looking at the process of art making in visual artists. They took 10 visual artists. You have a problem with the mic. Should I move it up?
seconds.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I had the computer problem first, so I didn't. Sorry. Okay, now they took 10 visual artists and interviewed them over the course of their creation of artworks, paintings, ceramics, and the like. And they interviewed them before, during, and after the process, and then tried to collate what are the mechanisms by which people go through this process of long-term creativity. And so I'm just actually, the scheme is much more complicated than this, but here's kind of my summary of Mason Ward's four phases. Initially, you go through this process of just, you know, conception. I'm going to do a painting rather than a ceramic or rather than a textile, just a broad strokes conception. Then you kind of hone in on particular ideas you're going to develop. You know, you go through the process, you make sketches, you start to produce the work. It's not good enough. You start again. You keep the good, get rid of the bad. You go through these cycles of generation and exploration. Then after some amount of time, it could be years, whatever, you have what you think is your completed work. And in the case of an artist, maybe you'll display that, you know, at a gallery. Maybe you'll put it back in the vault and not look at it for a while. But kind of four basic phases of long-term creativity within the scheme of this Jean Plour model. So I'm kind of arguing here that improvisation really has to find a place within creativity theory and not be a separate topic that's divided from creativity. Okay, so I've talked to a lot of people at this conference, and a lot of it is driven kind of like these postmodern ideas about free improvisation. But when I come from the perspective of anthropology and ethnography. When I read the literature about improvisation, there's no mention at all about freedom at all. Improvisation is very constrained if you look at world cultures. And so people talk about guided improvisation, not free improvisation. I think that's a very postmodern notion that's in the last few years. But if you look at world cultures, when people write about improvisation, it's always about guided improvisation. Improvisation is very constrained by stylistic and syntactic considerations. If you go to a performance of Indian classical music, the very first thing you're going to hear is the scale. The raga is going to be played immediately. And for the next sort of 90 minutes, all you're going to hear are the tones from that particular raga or scale. So, I mean, very, very constrained. You have all these constraints about the genre, about the syntax that are guiding the improvisation. It's not this free process that postmodern people talk about, except in the West. And so improvisation is based on a bunch of a procedural repertoire. People learn formulas. People learn elements that get recombined during the process of improvisation. So it's very constrained. It's very procedural. And so, again, just a point I want to make about the field, you know, since we have this conference that's supposed to kind of, you know, bring us together, that there's a very rich literature about improvisation that goes back to the 80s and before. And this work by Pressing is about jazz improvisation. Pretty much all the ideas that were discussed at this conference are there in this 1988 chapter. So we don't want to reinvent the wheel. I mean, there's a really rich literature about improvisation, especially going back to the work of people like Pressing on jazz. I just want to mention one particular idea from Pressing. Again, there's so much in his work, but I just want to mention one particular idea. Because when you talk about improvisation, the big challenge, how do you keep it going? How do you not stop? And so he talks about two different kinds of transitions during improvisation. One kind he calls associative transitions that are exploratory, that when you get going with improvisation, pretty much you're going to follow along the same thread for a while. But then at particular points, you may have what he calls interruptive transitions, where now you're going to make a rupture with what's going on. You're going to start a new path. And then once you make this interruption, you're going to then associatively transition for a while until the next interruption. So this is one particular concept that I find very informative for this conference, different kinds of transitions, especially just simple continuations that are associative versus having these big ruptures that now start a new thread of the improvisation. So can we use sort of the Mace model and think about how can we think about improvisation in the context of sort of a Jean Plour kind of model? So I think we'd have to start out with this kind of planning, but not in the performance, but offline. So one of my graduate students is an improv actor. He talks about all the exercises and the games they do outside of performance to prepare themselves for actually doing it in a performance. So there's so much planning that goes in doing all the preparation and exercises that occur offline. Long before you ever perform, you've gone through all these exercises. Then you get to the point of actually doing performance. And then performance, you have to now do planning online in the moment in the context of performance and do all this kind of feedback between online planning and performance. And according to Pressing, you know, a big driving force here is this contrast between either associative transitions that keep things going along the same path or more interruptive things that make a break. But basically, online planning, performing, this kind of loop. We can now make a joint. I just took the same thing and made it two times over. So we have all this feedback within the person. But then, of course, during joint improvisation, we have to talk about now interpersonal mechanisms. So this person's action now is going to feedback to this person's planning and vice versa. But in addition to this online feedback, I mentioned people do this offline as well. People practice outside of performance. They're doing all this interpersonal stuff, like these contact people. I'm sure you have all these exercises for doing this in preparation long before you ever get onto the stage. At least improv actors do. I've not done the contact stuff, but I assume it's the same mentality. So this is a conference about joint improvisation. What's joint about joint improvisation? So again, this is the way I think about this topic, and I think I want to convince you this is the way to go. I'm not going to kind of veer from this, that I think improvisation definitely has to fit. Yeah, I'm very rigid now about this. So has to fit within this umbrella of creativity, either like two time frames, either the long term or the spontaneous. This can be done either by individuals or by groups. So this could be one playwright or novelist writing a book on his or her own, organizing a conference. We've been in contact for a year. You've gone through a million versions of this program to get to today. Like, it didn't happen as an improvisation. It was many iterations of the program. So most creativity is done not by individuals, but it's done by teams of people working together. And so most long-term creativity is joint. Same kind of thing here. We could have individuals and groups. So think about a sitar player or a jazz pianist doing solo. But now I want to say that there are four ways of doing this. Okay, so you're going to hate this. You're going to, whatever. You're going to jump on me. But this is my take of the four different ways of doing joint improvisation. I have this as a 2x2 scheme, either alternating parts or simultaneous parts, and either one or two people improvising at a time. So I'm going to make a 2x2 scheme here. So the first one I'm going to call solo in a group. This is going to be the typical jazz ensemble. So when the jazz players play together, typically it's fixed parts, and then you have these solos. But the solos are serial. So first it's going to be the saxophone player for 5 minutes. Then it's going to be the trumpet player for 5 minutes. So it's sort of, one improviser at a time in the context of a group. In the case of improv actors, now you have two improvisers, but they're doing this in alternation. So one actor speaks, the other one improvises, the other one. They go back and forth as an alternation. So there are two improvisers, but it's happening as an alternation between the two. It's not happening at the same time. Then we have these forms of simultaneous improvisation. This one I'm going to call improviser and follow, exemplified by tango dancing. So typically in tango dancing, only the leader is improvising. The follower, as I'll talk about soon, is kind of tracking the leader's movements. So there's really only one improviser, even though both people are performing at the same time. And then we have the most complex situation that I understand the least based on my own life experience. And this will be simultaneous improvisation by more than one performer. So for example, contact improv, or jamming by musicians, where you have two improvisers and they're doing it at the same time. So this is kind of my schema for the four ways of doing joint improvisation. And definitely a big issue that we have to address is this whole thing about leading and following. It's going to be really critical to understand how joint improvisation works. These are very complementary or reciprocal roles. As you know, the leader does things like the leader makes decisions. The leader is the one who plans the movements. If there's going to be movement, is the initiator of the action. If there's going to be movements, the person's going to navigate, say, the couple or the group through space. There's going to be the one who's going to do all the pushing and the pulling, conveying the forces. The follower has a reciprocal role. It's going to be the one who has to be responsive to all these cues coming from the leader. And it's basically going to be tracking the motion, tracking the cues coming from the leader's movement. So if I then bring back my four-way scheme, I would say in these situations of, say, like jazz or improv acting, we have alternation between, so one leader at a time going through alternation. Tango dancing, I think there's pretty much a fixed leader. Typically, you don't switch roles in the middle of a dance. One person is the leader throughout a dance, and maybe they switch after. In this one, I've talked to people. I don't understand this one very well. They say there's no leader. I don't really buy it myself, but, I have a lot to learn about this particular form. But at least, on paper, people say there's no leader. Okay, so I'll leave that. I'll leave that for now. When I come back to gym 2017 or something, I'll have new ideas about this. But for now, I don't buy that story, but that's what I'm told by people who do it. Okay, I'm going to switch now to neuroscience. I know it's not a neuroscience crowd, but we have a few neuroscientists here. So neuroscience of improvisation. So typically what you do in neuroscience is you make a contrast between two conditions, and you contrast the brain activity. So typically for improvisation, you'll compare an improvisation task with something pre-learned. So for example, you'll take a pianist and have the pianist do improvisation, and then you'll compare that with, for example, playing a major scale, and say what's more active in the brain when people have to improvise than when they do something pre-learned, like playing a major scale. Another kind of comparison is to imitation. So, for example, studies of creative drawing, they'll have people draw creatively, and they compare that with, okay, here's a picture of a house, make a copy of the house. So what's more active when people have to freely draw compared to when they have to do something that's an imitation? And here's my take. I mean, I've read a lot of this literature. This is my own idea. This is not from nothing published. But to me, there are basically two neural models of creativity, and I will call them enhancement and expansion. Again, this is not anything published. This is my own analysis of a big literature, where enhancement is something very domain-specific, and expansion is something domain-general. So on this slide, I'm going to use NC to mean non-creative task and C to mean a creative task. So in the enhancement model, when you're doing something non-creative, for example, just playing a major scale or pre-learned, you'll have a certain level of activity in the so-called premotor or motor planning areas. And then when you start doing improvisation, what you see is an increase in activity, but in the same domain-specific motor planning area. So if you're looking at, you know, the motor areas for the hands, so there's a certain level of activation when you were just playing scales, and now it's going to increase. So this I'll call enhancement. Expansion is very different, and it's much more domain general. And now we're talking about brain areas involved not in domain specificity, but working memory, attention, associative function, executive function. Here's my graphic here, is that in the non-creative condition, my conceptual space is this big. It's just this little box. And then in my creative condition, the box is bigger. There's an expansion. Now I can see, oh, there are connections I didn't see before. Okay, thanks. I see new connections I didn't see before. So again, it's very domain general, but it's kind of like my conceptual space has gone from being this smaller box, and now in the creative condition, I start to see new things that I didn't see before. So again, it's not domain specific like all this planning, motor planning stuff. It's much more, okay, I have a bigger conceptual space. So I'll contrast enhancement versus expansion. Okay, so Guillaume made a point yesterday that I so strongly agree with that I have to say it again, that if we're going to look at the neuroscience of interaction, it can't be doing one person at a time. It has to be doing something joint. You use EEG, I use fMRI, but it's the same idea that you can't look at all joint improvisation looking just at one person. You have to have two person or more. And so you made the point, and I agree so totally with that I want to say it again. So here's I'm going to talk about the results of the first fMRI study of joint improvisation. It's not published yet. We're writing it up. Involving physical contact. This was done by my PhD student, Léa Chauvignier, with help from another student, Michelle Bellick, but this is all pretty much Léa's project for her PhD. Okay, so we took our participants were a bunch of people trained in couple dancing, so people with experience in tango, salsa, swing, and ballroom, and we have 18 subjects, 9 males, 9 females. And they weren't professionals, but people who were highly trained. So if you've danced salsa for 8 years, you tend to be very, very good at salsa. Not professionals, but people who are very experienced amateurs of these dancers. We gave people a self-report analysis to rate how good are you at leading versus following at your dance on a scale of 1 to 10. Not surprisingly, the men said that they were better leaders than followers, and the females said they were better followers than leaders. But in case you're not a dancer, I want to point out that this number here is not zero. If you've been dancing tango for 8 years, I'm sure that you know how to lead. I know how to follow. I'm not a good follower, but I'm probably like a 3.4. Well, how would you rate yourself as a leader in tango?
Yeah, about
that. About a 2.9. Yeah, I mean, you're part of the group here. Okay, so so these numbers are not zero. For people who've danced this long, they're something like halfway towards the competence. Okay, so we had experienced leaders and followers in the study. And again, so here we're trying to look at differences in the brain between being a leader, being a follower. The leader, in this case of contact, has to think about the motor planning, about the navigation, about the push-pull conveying forces. The follower has to be very responsive to the cues for force and navigation coming from the leader, and essentially to track the motion of the leader. And so these are very complementary roles. And so if you talk with dancers about, you know, the other sex, the major complaint that women will say about men is, I couldn't feel his lead. Like, he was pushing me and pulling me, but I couldn't really figure out what he wanted me to do. So he wasn't doing this very well. I couldn't feel his lead. The major complaint by men about women She was very stiff. I was trying to lead her into this, and she didn't move. She was, you know, she was very stiff. And so being good at this means really having very strong signals about navigation, about forces. Being good here means having just a real receptivity to the cues coming from the leader. In addition to looking at these really asymmetric roles, I wanted to look at something much more symmetric that I'm going to refer to as the mutual. And so here, to do this properly, we couldn't do improvisation the way you might want us to do. In order to look at this egalitarian thing, we had to look at people doing something which they both knew that was non-improvised. So let me just show you what people were doing in the scanner. We developed a novel two-person MRI. Can we turn this light down? I'm going to show brain images now. So, yeah, thanks. That's just for the next few minutes. I'm going to show brain images. A two-person scanning paradigm where the subject is being scanned, interacting with the hands with an experimenter standing next to the bore of the MRI scanner. So there's going to be two-person interaction. This took us a full year to work out because there are all these artifacts with the magnetic fields. It was very time-consuming to pilot this. But after a year, we finally got conditions where there weren't artifacts with the MRI. So we have this two-person scanning arrangement with the experimenter standing next to the subject who's in the MRI being scanned. The actual embrace is not this. It's actually this, where the participant has their palm up and the experimenter has the palm down. And so here's what they're doing. This is joint improvisation. So there's leading and follow. I'm going to show you now just the leading condition, but this is now not in the scanner, but in my lab. So here's the subject with their hands up. Here's the experimenter. And now he is leading her in this joint improvisation task. Okay, so that was leading. The same thing would happen in following, except now the experimenter would be the leader, and the subject and the scanner would be following the cues coming from the leader. Again, then we wanted to have this more egalitarian thing, a mutual, and so we taught the subjects three different fixed patterns. And so just to show you what here, there were three, and they were cued to do one of these three. So again, this is non-improvised. They learned it before the scan, and they were just cued to do this. Okay, so here's our experimental design. It's a simple 2x2. People either did improvised or pre-learned patterns and either partnered with the experimenter or solo. This will be leading and following. This we'll call mutual. And then we have these control conditions where the subject just performed without a partner. And if it was improvised, we called that solo. If it was pre-learned, we called that alone. Importantly, the subject's eyes were closed, so there was no visual contact between the two, and so all the contact was just, you know, tactile, proprioceptive. There was no visual contact between the two, all just somatosensory in this experiment. Okay, so the first thing I want to look at, what's is partnership. Which part of the brain is more active when you do movements with a partner compared to when you do the movements by itself? Okay, so I think we can make some very strong predictions about this because if I'm doing it solo, I'm doing this. If I'm doing it with a partner, I have a lot of contact, so there's going to be tactile interaction. But more importantly, proprioceptive. I'm going to be feeling the push and pull of the partner. So we expect to see differences related to somatosensory function. And indeed, so here's the contrast. What's more active in partnered versus non-partnered? And again, I know that you're not neuroscientists here, but these regions, so S1 and S2, this is called the primary somatosensory cortex and the secondary somatosensory cortex, the main cortical areas involved in the perception of touch, and also proprioception. This region called the mid-cingulate cortex is part of the brain involved in body orientation in response to touch, especially to painful stimuli. You talked about the insula yesterday. Very similar idea about this limbic area that makes you move in response to sensory stimuli. I'll talk about this shortly. It's called the superior temporal sulcus. It's an area involved in the perception of motion. And so doing things with a partner, you're perceiving the motion of your partner. And so we see areas involved in motion perception. I'll talk about that in another slide. Okay, so of course the big question for us is what's the brain area for, you know, is this? What's the specificity now for being a leader versus being a follower versus doing this mutually? So I'm going to look now at these specific activations. So I mentioned being a leader is very much this kind of, this is the motor profile. You're navigating, you're initiating, and using forces. And so the pattern for leading the specific is very much a motor pattern. So we see activations in areas like the premotor cortex here, cingulate motor area involved in motor planning, supplementary motor area involved in bimanual coordination, inferior frontal gyrus involved in creating sequences, motor sequences, including language syntax is involved in that, cerebellum involved in error correction, fine-tuning of movement. So we see very strongly a motor profile for leading. Before I talk about following, I just want to take one digression here, because I think it's the most important topic for this conference. What's the difference between improvising with a partner versus improvising by yourself? I think that's kind of a key question for people at this conference. So before I talk about following, I just want to digress and say, what's the difference between improvising with a partner versus improvising solo? Of course, one thing is this, is the contact. I've already talked about that. So definitely one thing we're going to expect is the somatosensory difference. And so here's going to be the pattern for leading greater than solo. The pattern is nothing more. We see, I just talked about S1, S2. All we see are the partnering areas. And so the conclusion from this that I think is very important for this group is that improvising with a partner is really nothing more than the additive combination of improvising on your own plus the contact that comes from the partner. Going into this, I thought, oh, there's going to be something more than just this very simple additivity. But based on this experiment, using a very simple task, improvising with a partner is really nothing more than simply adding together the brain areas involved in improvising by yourself plus the brain areas involved in creating contact. We didn't see anything more than just this kind of additivity. Let me go now to following. Again, we expect the follower now to be something much more about the receptivity. And so now if we look at the brain areas specific for following, we don't see the motor areas. We see much more of a sensory profile. So again, we see the sensory part of the thalamus. Again, this S2, the secondary somatosensory cortex. But I want to focus on, in particular, these areas here. So this region called MT stands for middle temporal. It was discovered in monkeys in 1990 as being an area for visual motion perception. So these are cells, if you have the monkey looking either at moving things or stationary, is much more responsive to moving things than state. So this was the first area of the brain found to be important for motion perception, but it's a visual area. And I mentioned that these people, they have their eyes closed. There's no vision here. So why are we seeing this visual motion area for this task? Well, 10 years later with fMRI, people found that the same complex was found, thanks, when there was tactile motion. So if you stroked people's skin and had tactile motion compared to stationary, MT was found to be activated for tactile motion in addition to visual motion. In our particular case, when people do leading and following, the tactile contact is the same. So what this is reflecting really here is the proprioceptive contact here. The followers have to be much more receptive to proprioceptive motion coming from the leader than would the leader be. So essentially, these are areas that would be involved in tracking the motion of your partner, and this is what followers have to do much more than leaders, and that's why we see these motion areas much more during following than we do with leading. Okay, so I've just talked about leading and following. What about this more mutual thing, this pre-learned thing? So we talked about mutual, much more symmetric movements. This is much more now cooperative, it's egalitarian, there's not this leader-follower separation. They're doing the same thing, non-improvised movements. So one question we can ask about this now egalitarian thing is that, is mutual a form of mutual leading? Could it be a form of mutual following? Is it something altogether different? Okay, so now if I look at the pattern for mutual, the first thing I can tell you off the bat is that we don't see any motor areas. There's no evidence that mutual is a form of mutual leading. There's some evidence that there's some mutual following, so this STS area is involved in motion perception. We saw it with following, as you can see in blue. So some evidence that mutual is kind of mutual following. But then, actually, I think you made reference a little bit, this network here, I won't talk about the names, but these areas collectively are part of the so-called theory of mind network, mentalizing network. And it looks like that during this mutual thing, people are thinking much more about other people's minds, their thoughts and feelings, much more so during the mutual than during leading following. So there seems to be this thing about you're doing theory of mind, you're mentalizing about your partner. My favorite part of this about the results are these areas, and actually you talked about the amygdala. So during the mutual, we see activations in these emotion areas. This area is one of the pleasure centers. So when people watch pornography or take drugs of addiction like cocaine or have chocolate, this is the part of the brain that is kind of the signal about reward. And we're seeing this come up in mutuals. So people talk about, you know, the flow, whatever, the, you know, being cooperative and having all this kind of mutuality can be pleasurable. And we're seeing that in terms of these emotion areas. The basic summary of the experiments, so again, for leading, very much in red here, very much a motor profile, following much more about perception, about motion tracking, and the mutual, again, mentalizing and this kind of emotion stuff. The last thing I want to show before concluding, again, of interest to this group, is this one, the improvisation contrast. So which part of the brain is more active when you have to improvise compared to when you do fixed patterns, regardless of whether it's partnered or solo? I talked about two predictions about this. I said that we could either see sort of enhancement, domain-specific premotor stuff, or we can see these more general working memory areas. And so what's the result in our particular case? So here's the profile for improvised versus fixed or non-improvised. And we see a very strongly motor profile indicative of enhancement. So we see all these areas that I talked about for leading, all these motor planning areas are coming up very strongly in this contrast. So we see a very strong evidence for enhancement, stimulation of the basic premotor circuit. But in addition, we do see evidence for the other. So this lateral prefrontal cortex is a classic working memory attentional area. So we see a combination of the premotor story, but also evidence in lateral prefrontal cortex of expansion and increases in working memory capacity. I have like a minute. I still have a minute or something? Okay. So anyway, but here's, I finished in time. So here's my take-home message for Asaf and the new field he's trying to create of joint improvisation. So I feel very strongly about this, that improvisation is part of the study of creativity and that we have to really move beyond this big divide between creativity and improvisation. Especially for people in this field, we have to be consulting models about creativity. Likewise, we have to take advantage of a very rich literature about improvisation. It's mainly focused on jazz and musical improvisation, but pretty much all the ideas that we need for this field are found in literature from decades ago about the psychology of improvisation. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We want to take advantage of what's been done before us. And then finally, this notion about leading and following. The joint improvisation needs a theory of leading and following from the study of joint action. So these are kind of my three take-home messages. We can discuss that and... Thank you.
Thank you for a very nice talk. We open the discussion now. Okay.
We need the microphone.
Yeah, it seems to work. Yes. And this? Okay, who's first?
Okay. Thank you, Stephen. This was very valiant effort to try to frame a lot of the big questions here and also really nicely combined with some empirical work. I really admire. I mean, I think the fMRI, it's a great paradigm. At the same time, I must say that it's interesting to see how deeply I disagree with some of the basic, so it was really interesting to witness like how, and it was good, really good, I think, for that to be formulated clearly, so it could be, okay, Where do things differ? I'll make three points that I think from the, chronologically, but I think they also. One point I think about what's the relationship between creativity and improvisation. I suggest a phrase I heard from Steve Paxton, who was the discoverer of contact improvisation and otherwise a great improviser, and he told me once a phrase which was very meaningful for me. Which is improvisation is the study of composition.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is different than saying improvisation is composing. And I think it's actually, in that sense, really interesting to think that maybe when you're improvising, we are not being creative or we are not composing. We're actually mainly, what is really the improvisation part is actually the state or the what we learn online, how we online investigate that same process. And I think that's actually what makes, I think, particularly for me, improvisation.
Is that different than what
when I talk about it, I say a biologist is someone who studies life, is not someone who is living, right? I mean, or a chemist, not a chemist, someone who does chemistry. Mm-hmm. He's not, you know, when he's studying processes in chemistry, he's not the thing. So I think improviser is not composing as much as studying composition. I think it's that kind of difference. But anyway, longer discussion. The second point, I think, is about the leading following. Once again, here, doing also quite a few years of tango now, and as well, where there's clear roles. I refuse to use the word leader and follower. I use men, women, not for the sex, gender, but to those roles that I'm still needing a better name for, which I did not find. I disagree that leading is and following are that strictly separated.
Yeah.
And
I think
I think when you lead, you do a lot of following. Actually, technically in tango, if you actually look, and I think Michael's work could be interesting there, that you'll see this afternoon. Some, I don't know what he will present of that, but he has done a lot of work on. I think there's a lot of interesting things about what is the actual temporal relationship, for example, within following leading. So I think there's nuance there. So I'm just bringing that out. And my third, and that will be where the question is, relating to your old work on tango, which was also great, your pet work, you did not use music in your fMRI study.
Right, right.
And so I'm interested to what extent, and there is this work on tango by, on hormonal changes in tango, one of the only work I know. And they've shown that it's the combination of music and a partner that actually gives you the feel. Like you actually see it both in ratings, subjective ratings, and in hormonal changes. And so to what extent do you think they're actually... Are you getting those ballroom dancers into a state of improvising?
Mm-hmm. So as far as leading and following, I agree totally. I'm trying to make a very dichotomous scheme here just to contrast that with others. But I mean, Saul made the point from actually a paper of ours about that if you're dancing to tango, now you have two different kinds of cues. You have the music to entrain to, and you have your partner. If we had the music here, it would have sort of confounded that. And so we want to have just the somatosensory. We can do the next experiment now with music, but going into the study, the first two-person study with music would have had two different cues. It would have taken a lot of conditions to control for the music, control for the touch. And so at least for this first study, we had enough to do with the touch. But yeah, I think the next level is then to have all these cues about touch and then throw in this joint signal about entrainment to the music, which had been done with finger tapping so much anyway. So like that wasn't new so much to have the entrainment to music because there's a huge literature on entrainment to finger tapping. Yeah, the state. No, I agree. Actually, we first started the study with music, and we decided to get rid of it because it was just so complex. Think about what about this two-person thing? Is it the music, and what is the touch? And so let's just do the touch thing. But I agree totally. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I'm sweating. Yeah, yeah.
I have one big problem with your talk, which is
just one.
I think it's a pretty big one.
Okay.
Which is, you're speaking of improvisation falling within the umbrella of creativity,
yeah.
Which I think is interesting. At the same time that you say that there is no improvisation and no creativity.
Sorry?
In your presentation, within the graphic,
yeah.
You speak as non-improvised,
okay,
also as non-creative. And I would like to know what that is. If you think that they're actually possible not to improvise and not to be creative.
Yes, yeah, so I gave the example that of the piano studies where they have pianists doing improvisation, and for the control, they'll have them playing C major scale. So they're not composing the scale. It's a fixed pattern that they've learned before the study. So for me, that's not creative. They're not composing anything there. It's a pre-learned.
My question is, do you really believe that a living body will always do exactly
yeah.
the same?
Yeah, I mean, so that's...
activity.
I knew this question was coming. I knew this question was coming, and that's why I had this slide here for this exactly this question, because I knew this was going to come in this talk, my Olivier slide. So this one here, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I mean, so I think, yeah, Olivier is, I think, a very talented, very creative interpreter. But as I said, he's not Shakespeare. He didn't write Romeo and Juliet.
It's a judgment value. It's
okay.
All there is.
So that's where we're going to.
It's just a judgment.
I know.
Value.
So that's where we're going to disagree. We're going to disagree. I think that what Shakespeare is doing is something different fundamentally than what Olivier is doing. I think he's a creative performer. He's a creative writer. To me, they're not the same thing. And so.
I disagree.
Yeah, I know. That's why I had this slide because I knew this question was coming up and I wanted to have this ready.
And you're very well prepared, and it doesn't help me. So I profoundly disagree.
Yeah, I mean, we disagree on this point, but I mean,
I think that from the perspective as a dancer, that makes no sense. I think that makes no sense.
I think there's creative performance and there's creative
it's
composition.
It's a judgment value, I keep my stance.
Yeah.
It's your first time as
chair. Yeah, exactly.
I have two questions about the model of improvisation, which is not improvisation to my understanding. It's a model, right? I mean, you assume that this is improvisation.
Yes, it's my own take on it.
Because we don't have portable, it hasn't been invented yet, the portable fMRI that you can take along with you, because there are improvisations that you're aware of that have no contact, physical contact. There's no physical contact in a lot of improvisation. So what would be...
I mean, the fMRI study.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely... No. Well, there's been a lot on piano improvisation, creative drawing, I mean, there's a big literature.
No,
there's a lot. This is the first two-person experiment, but there's lots on one person writing,
drawing. No, I'm talking about two persons or more.
This is the first study of its kind. Yeah, so you'll have to come back in a few years and see where the field's going, but this is...
And why are the eyes shut?
Yeah, exactly, because, first of all, you can't see your partner either way. And, there's no way to see your partner in this MRI situation anyways.
Right.
But it was kind of like the tango. You talk about feeling the music. We wanted people to kind of feel... That would have been a confounding factor, I think, to have visual things. There's nothing to look at, for one thing. What's changing is all this contact here, and so... No, it's very common in MRI experiments. If you're not doing something visual,
I asked Michael about a similar thing about his experiment, dividing wall. And I'm thinking these models are so reductive. There's so little left of real improvisation in them. Why take away a form of communication present in improvisation?
When you're inside this tube, you're up to your waist. There's really no way to see the person anyways. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't feasible to have... I mean,
and yet you marked that it was important that the eyes are shut.
I say that kind of post hoc because we see all these very classic visual motion areas, and we say, I can't attribute it to the fact that there was visual motion because they had their eyes closed. I was doing it more because we have actually a very novel finding with this MT thing, but I want to make sure people don't think it's due to the fact that there was visual contact. So... No, I was just trying to explain the experiment. That's the condition, is that we have the eyes closed. Other experiments, they have the eyes open. There's not much interactive MRI occurring anyway, so it's kind of a moot point for this study. But I just wanted to... I knew I was going to talk about this motion stuff, and I want to say it's not due to the fact that there was visual motion at all because they had their eyes closed.
Thank you.
Yeah, so it's very reductive, and I understand this is neuroscience stuff. But I think what they were doing was definitely... It was joint improvisation. There's no question that this task, very simple... It's not much different than what you might be doing with a partner and contact.
There is a question in my mind. I mean, it may have a nucleus of improvisation. Because if you're talking about... You would accept that blind people can improvise, for example, right?
Yeah.
And so they don't see, right? And so it's still improvisation, right? So I mean, it's reducing in some way, but it also makes experiments...
But blind people... Sense everything differently, so they use, I'll be talking about deaf people, they sense everything differently, so it's, I don't think it's,
Thank you, that was I read the paper and referenced it because I really enjoyed it and found it really useful. The thing that I think jumps out to me from this talk is the issue of leading and following, and I do think it's important to acknowledge those roles, but to separate them from their gender stereotypes, because that doesn't give them the value as resources. These are performative resources in dance as in everyday life, and the temporal offset between the initiation and the response to a lead and a follow about constraints. So the initiation of the movement and the completion of the movement introduce a set of constraints on what can happen next, which I think is part of the story that may not be available. Partly in the experimental design, you'll get other things, but I also think that's a different way of...
Well, we're doing parallel work with motion capture, so we have a whole separate set of studies looking at motion capture to look at leading and following, so that's separate from the MRI, of course.
Right, I guess just the issue of constraints, other people in the room, how the response to an initiation sets up what can happen next, that's not something that I think is reflected in the distinctions that you're making between lead and follow.
Okay, hi.
Hi.
I was wondering about the brain research, the one, the slide of the leader. Can you go back?
In my study?
Yeah,
in
your study. I think that was the the IFG activation was only for the leader, right?
Only for the leader, yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder, I just want to mention that in our lab, we just published a paper that another TDCS over the right IFG actually increases creativity.
Say it again. I'm sorry. I was there.
Okay. I'm just saying that in our lab, TDCS, another TDCS over the right IFG actually increases creativity.
You've done this. You've done the study.
Ah, okay.
I'm sorry. You did it, or?
Ah, okay. You'll have to help me with the neuroscience.
Brain stimulation.
It's a brain stimulation, and it increases the activity of that region. Okay, the right IFG, and yeah, it's one of our lab members.
What task was used to gauge creativity?
She uses the alternative Pavlov.
Okay, okay.
Anyway, I'll let you know later. I think the alternate uses and the NAMA.
The torrents
and so on.
Okay, that's very different than what I'm talking about for artistic improvisation.
But I'm just saying that you can just, maybe one of them, a conclusion, it's not, it's very speculative, but anyway, you can say that the IFG is, the fact that the leader only it activates in lid, it means that he's maybe is the more creative one.
It's consistent with that. Mm-hmm. Is that published work? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, you can maybe get me the reference. And.
So, okay. First, wonderful talk, Stephen, and good point for us in the conference. I felt it was very clear. Had signs of good art in the sense it was very clear and very provocative. So I see many responders. I also have a lot of feeling about this. I will express some of them. And I asked Valeria to give us a few more time. And I want us to try to frame it, not that we are attacking you, but just we have...
Oh, of course.
So because I feel that we have a little bit. I agree to many, many of the points you there. This creativity improvisation, I think it's a wonderful point on. We need to take it into account. What for me was a bit disturbing was this differentiation between solo and leader. And what I heard, maybe I heard not correctly, is that you think that the only difference is a body contact.
In my particular study, you're talking about.
Yeah, okay. Exactly right. So first, just in terms of kind of, there is maybe a logical flaw because you didn't see a difference, but maybe there are differences there that you didn't see. So this
is absolutely. Yeah. That's one study.
It seemed like you are making a general claim, and I think this is what Ati was saying. So I can test from my case. We let people play the mirror game by themselves, just improvise movement. So this will be a solo.
Yeah.
And they're playing with someone else. It's a totally different ball game. There is no contact, but there is conversation, engagement, you know, joint things that are happening. Perception of the other. So for me, it's almost intuitive that when you improvise with someone else, there is something else going on than improvising.
I thought so too. No, I mean, you're talking about at the behavioral level. I agree totally. I'm just talking about what the brain, looking inside the box, what that's told us. I'm not trying to say that what you're saying is not the case. Obviously, behaviorally, absolutely.
Can we agree that so far you saw no differences, but it's possible that there are some differences?
No, I gave a disclaimer. I said this is a very simple experiment. It's only one experiment. Oh, yeah, no, there's, you know, hopefully in the next few years, people will start doing, like Guillaume was saying, start doing two-person work, but hasn't started yet. But, you know, a few hyper-scanning things. And no, it's a very new field. No, I hope people will see this difference that I haven't seen here. That's what I'm saying. That's why I gave a lot of time to that, because I said this is very important for this group. It's very surprising. I was expecting to see differences which we didn't see, and it's one experiment. But at least it's a very clear result.
Definitely.
It's kind of a negative for us, but it's a clear result. So.
So thank you for clarifying it.
Yeah, yes. No, but I agree. Yeah, absolutely.
Hi. One more specific, more fMRI question.
Yeah.
Like, rather than... is there any chance that you could, I mean, even though you just have one person in the scanner, but wouldn't it be like just having the analysis based on one person? Is there any way that you can compare sort of having had both people in the scanner that you can look at joint activations during these
tests? I don't know if you were here the first day, but Chris Kaiser has actually done that with the charades game and taken the two partners and scanned them sequentially. So that would have been... That's feasible. We didn't do it that way. We had one experimenter and then 18 subjects. But Chris Kaiser has actually done this, where people playing charades and taking the senders and receivers and scanning both of them to see what they share. So it's been done, I think, just one time. I think it's the one study that's been done.
There are other
of what? What, putting people in and out like that?
Yeah.
Okay. You probably know this literature a lot better than I do.
Many?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Actually, like, the number of publications is like that.
Okay. No, I haven't followed the field as closely as you have, but also it's been done, obviously, and it's quite, we could have done that, but.
No, I guess the reason why I'm asking is, in some ways, like, if you sort of establish the leader-follower relationship as sort of fixed for like a block, in some way, to my mind, you take away everything that would be about the flexibility of a joint action in the sense that who does what.
Okay, these were 30 second blocks. So it wasn't like a full tango dance. It was 30 seconds and then a break. Like, there were, I think, 7 different tasks, and they were just randomly sequenced. So no, there wasn't time to have this relationship. Obviously, like, this is MRI, so it's not. But no, I mean, people did switch between being leading and following. That was the major goal. I think we achieved that part. But as far as being flexible and, you know, like. It's not the real world. It's someone in a big tube interacting with someone next to them. So it's not a real world situation. But it's the best that we can do, I think, right now. And it was like a huge challenge to even get to this point for us.
So thanks for talking about Jeff Pressing. I think that if he was still alive, he'd probably be here.
He died very young. He died very prematurely.
Yeah. And so I guess, like, what I found that his theories don't help me understand is, so you can have all these motor plans and you can practice this vocabulary if we're talking about music improvisation, but it doesn't really help you understand how, in the context of the interaction, choices are being made.
Yeah, and he talks about that very clearly. Yeah.
But this is where I think it's kind of difficult to reduce to the individual, because in the dynamics of the interaction, what choices are made when what information is being used to make those choices, I think makes it difficult to talk about the individual when they're practicing before they interact and not focusing on the coupling in the actual context of the interaction.
Yeah, I mean, so Pressing talks about what a huge mystery this is to talk about this, even for individuals, how they continue on and generate material. And it's, of course, much more difficult in the joint situation. So nobody has the answers, but I think he's at least addressed that's an important question. He has these transition ideas that I talked a little bit about. So that's what the field is really going to be oriented towards, is exploring the cues for continuing and having this kind of smooth flow during the course of improvisation.
And so I don't want this to be a criticism of fMRI, but in that context, you're taking away so much of the information that might help you understand the choices that are being made, such as this perception.
That's what I'm saying. We're doing motion capture. We've talked about that, doing motion capture to look at the leading and following. It's not very easy. There aren't motion cues that we can look at in the MRI. So it's all brain stuff. So no, we need like your kind of lab to do the leading and following, which we're trying to do in addition to this.
So I go back to the creativity. For a second.
Which one?
I really like
the slide?
No, I don't need the slide.
Oh, okay,
I don't need just
ahead.
The concept. Because there's a lot of people thinking, I mean, back to John Locke, right, that when you have a creative idea or when you create something, it is because you make a new connection between two things that exist, right? You find a new connection that no one has thought about it before, right? So this idea of sort of network of, you know, of basics that make you think differently makes you creative, either by serendipity or something like this. Is there a way to make this, project this into improvisation in the sense that, you know, there is a sort of a sequential starting or micro starting endpoints or two things that people actually connect together and take this kind of theory of creativity of thoughts into improvisation?
I mean, there are other fields that look at what they call conceptual blending. So it's more a field about looking at concepts than looking at performance improvisation. But people look at this whole thing about how do you form these conceptual blends. You have two categories, and then you form this kind of, you know, fusion. So there's work on that, but it's not in the context of performance. It's much more in the context of conceptual processing and forming conceptual blends. They use the term conceptual blends. So it's not the kind of thing that we tend to do in the performance side. It's just the same idea about making blends and making associations. But at least in the performance arena, it hasn't been looked at very much. It's much more in the conceptual processing area that people look at the conceptual blends. Like you talk about alternative uses, but looking at, you know, two concepts that are unrelated and find something that they have in common to create a fusion. So, but that's much more the linguistic domain than.
I'm aware that I'm going to make a lot of people unhappy, but I'm going to take the last couple of questions.
Thank you.
So I can take
Okay, I was I would be quick. So thank you very much. It was very interesting, and I really liked the.
the way you shape it from a different perspective and with calm.
thanks to Yvonne, because I did the relaxation exercise.
So my question is related to what you raised with this MT and the fact that we tend in neuroscience to attribute cognitive functions to blobs. And the same way, for instance, you show the theory of mind network, which is also found in related to default mode and stuff like that. And I want to bridge that with what you said about leading versus solo, like what's the difference to be together by adding up, like it's improv plus partnering. And there's all these debates with, is there something more when you are improvising? So for instance, Chris Frist talk about this we mode, like there is something in the brain that is a new mode. Mm. And on the other side, there are people talking about that from a perspective that there is like mutual entrainment, so that, for instance, this co-confidence dynamics that emerge, like, for instance, in swarm behavior or birds, that the comportment, the behavior of the group is more than the sum of them.
Absolutely, yeah.
So how do you think we can tackle that? Because it's indeed, in your work, there's the summation of two different things, but does it tell us that there is nothing more? Or?
Well, no, but I think our partnering, I have a mic. I think the partnering is our we mode. I think so all the activations that are reflected in our partnering contrast are what you're calling the we mode. As far as chopping them up into things that are just somatosensory versus cognitive, it's not so easy to tell right now. But so I think we have that we thing. But I was just saying that, in terms of just the activations, it was something like an additivity story, and we didn't see an interaction, like in an ANOVA. There was no interaction term. There was just the sum of the two. Again, it's one experiment, the one result, and hopefully you'll do some experiments like this down the road, and you'll find that there is some interaction term. We didn't find the interaction. We found just the sum. And so I made the point of talking about this because I think it's very important for the conference, and I can't change the data. Like, that's the result that we got.
I'd like to make a brief effort to broker a bit concerning the... Can you hear me?
Okay. Can you talk louder? Yeah.
I'd like to try to broker a bit concerning the disagreement that flared up between the two of you earlier on creativity, and draw attention to a distinction that's very important to me, and we actually talked about it last night as well, the distinction between the improvising, the what, and the how decision. And of course, I would agree that there's a lot of details getting filled in every possible motor situation, and the motor control literature really nicely underwrites that soft assembly at the subordinate levels, even when you have a sort of a clear scripted idea or motor program running. And also in the motor literature you have the interesting idea of functional equivalence, basically. So there are many possible different ways of producing the same result in terms of micro synergies, and I think this is probably the field of what one might call micro creativity. And I don't see the two of you actually being at odds with one another. If this was what you meant, that constant micro creativity always goes into whatever you're doing.
Well, I would have been happier if we had spoken of more or less creativity and not no improvisation and improvisation.
Yeah.
Sorry, but I think we really need to kind of...
That's a coffee break. Come on, let me get my...
Yeah, you can relax now. Thank you very much.